This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll decode hair loss in men and women with naturopath Dr. Colleen Hartwig. We'll discover how to overcome estrangement with authors Leslie and Lindsay Glass. We'll find out why religions are more alike than not with psychiatrist and author Dr. Ed Siegel. And lastly, we'll learn why people choose to stay in an abusive relationship with author Nicole Kranz. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. For years, people have been told that losing weight is simply a matter of eating less and exercising more. However, new research shows that the human body is designed to protect its fat stores, making weight loss much more difficult than people may realize. Scientists say that this survival system helped our early ancestors during times when food was scarce. Today, those same biological processes can work against people trying to lose weight. When someone loses weight, the body increases hunger, reduces the number of calories it burns, and even remembers a person's previous heavier weight. This helps explain why many people regain weight after dieting. Weight loss medications such as Wegovy and Mounjaro can reduce appetite by acting on the brain, but they do not work for everyone, and weight often returns after treatment ends. Researchers also stress that good health is about more than the number on the scale. Regular exercise, healthy eating, enough sleep, and good mental health all improve well-being. Experts say that tackling obesity will also require healthier communities, better nutrition for children, and new treatments that work with the body's biology instead of against it. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Colleen Hartwig in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. Dr. Colleen Hartwig is a licensed naturopathic physician who's been in private practice since 2012 in Campbell River, BC. Dr. Hartwig has a special interest in trauma as it pertains to physical illness, and as such, her practice focuses on mental health. In addition, Dr. Hartwig is passionate about sharing her knowledge and has been a part-time instructor at the Canadian School for Nutrition since 2015, and she publishes educational articles with Naturopathic Currents, and of course, she's a frequent guest on the show. Welcome back, Colleen. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm so glad to be back here for today's conversation.
So today we're talking about something that we typically don't cover on the show. However, it's something that is personal to me, and I understand how it impacts other people, and that is hair loss. So even though I'm on the radio, if you went to the website, you'd see a picture of me, and I am a bald man, and I started losing my hair noticeably at the age of 15. So it's something I've been coping with for a very, very long time, and I know for a lot of people, it can feel very personal. You ready to go with me?
I am. And honestly, I couldn't agree more. I see increasingly at the office, patients coming in, describing various patterns of hair loss. And to make it a little personal on my end too, I went through about a pretty significant hair loss in my early 20s. I'm gifted with quite a full head of hair. Yeah. I'm described as looking like Mufasa in my past, but I lost something like 30% of my hair. Fortunately, it did grow back.
Okay.
But just want to validate for you and for your audience how important this conversation is and how upsetting it can be to lose your hair. And it doesn't make you some egomaniacal, vain person, right? Our hair is tied to things like identity, to age, to culture. And as we're going to explore in this conversation, it's a huge health signal as well.
It is. And I'll tell you, you know, when I first got into health and wellness, I would go to CHFA, which is the big trade show. And back in the day before, this is when the regulations were just kicking in. There were all kinds of products out there designed theoretically to deal with hair loss. And I think, you know, what you and I will agree is there are some things that you can do depending on the circumstances of your hair loss, but there's no magic bullet. And it preys, you know, some of these products historically, although they're not around anymore, kind of prey on the weaknesses and the vanities of people who are stressed out because they're losing hair.
Oh, absolutely. You go from, again, having a full head of hair to noticing substantial loss, and you may feel nervous, panicked about it, and jump to the latest and greatest product or gimmick that's over-promising on what it can deliver.
Yeah.
And so what I'm hoping we'll do here is, again, talk through the different types of hair loss and how to best approach that so that you spare yourself more unnecessary suffering and the expense of trying a bunch of different gimmicks that may not deliver on their promises.
Okay. Well, let's start off with hair loss. Is it actually one condition?
It's not. And that's probably one of the most important grounding pieces for this conversation, is that hair loss is an umbrella term that's used to describe many patterns of hair loss, each of which has a different set of underlying causes. So you may have one person who experiences excessive shedding after an illness or a major stressor. That was the source of my hair loss in my 20s. Another person may be experiencing more gradual thinning of their hair due to underlying genetic factors. Some people may be experiencing more hair breakage, while others are experiencing inflammatory conditions that are damaging the hair follicles and showing up as patchy hair loss. So all of these situations seem really similar, and yet they have different underlying contributing factors that should be thoroughly evaluated and then treated appropriately. So before you jump to the internet or to the health food store and say, what should I take for my hair? The more important question, at least as a starting point, is what's actually happening to my hair and scalp?
Right. And one way to consider that is to look at the way in which your hair is, like, is it patchy, as you mentioned? Is it from a certain area? Is it following a pattern? How should people, like, look at that? What can they do, and what should they understand to help them understand the source of their hair loss?
Absolutely. So in practice, two of our most important clues that lead us down our next steps of which testing investigations do we do are, what is the pattern of hair loss, right? Is it patchy, like someone took a hole punch and took out a whole circle of hair? Mm-hmm. Is it more evenly distributed, as well as what's the location? Is it around the temples? Is it the crown of the head? So pattern of hair loss as well as location give us really valuable information about the type of hair loss and the most likely underlying factors.
We hear the term male pattern baldness all the time, but women can have genetic hair pattern loss too. Is the underlying symptomology the same?
Not quite, although they do share some similarities. So both male pattern hair loss as well as what's called female pattern hair loss can involve a genetic susceptibility of the hair follicles to hormones, specifically androgens like dihydrotestosterone. And so what ends up happening is as those hair follicles are exposed to androgens, they can start to shrink and produce thinner, finer, shorter hairs that have a shorter lifespan. But what we see that's different in men and women in part is the location. So with men, classically, male pattern hair loss shows up in the temples as well as the crown of the head, producing sort of an anterior M-shaped hairline. Women tend to experience more thinning across their central part as well as the front of their hairline. It's sometimes described in medicine as a Christmas tree pattern of hair loss. So how it appears in men and women looks a little bit different as well. While there does seem to be a hormonal component. When we look at women and say we test their blood work, we don't always see high levels of androgens, even though androgens can be a driver for female pattern hair loss. So again, what seems to be going on, at least in part, is that, again, we can have normal levels of testosterone and DHT, but those hair follicles, for genetic reasons, are really susceptible to androgen signaling. As well, in women, we can see an uptick in female pattern hair loss around menopause, likely influenced by declining levels of estrogen, which can negatively impact the hair follicles. And lastly, we can also see that insulin and insulin resistance may also be a driver for male, but especially female pattern hair loss. Do you want to make a note here that while both men and women can have this sort of genetic hormone mediated type of hair loss, that male and female pattern of hair loss can occur, as well as they may also have other underlying contributors or causes of hair loss, like telogen effluvium.
Should people who are losing the hair also be looking at the condition of their scalp and not just counting hairs in terms of, you know, the overall health of their hair or what might be causing the hair loss?
Yeah, absolutely. So while the primary focus for a lot of people is looking at their hair density and, you know, if you have longer hair, how thick is my ponytail? Is that changing? We also do want to look at the health of the scalp. So if you're seeing signs or symptoms like redness, really scaly scalp, pustules, so like acne-like lesions, marked itching, pain, tenderness, or burning sensations in the scalp, there's very likely something more than ordinary run-of-the-mill hair thinning that's going on. Those symptoms are highly suggestive of an inflammatory disorder that's damaging the not just the scalp, but the hair follicles as well, and can produce over time something like, say, smooth or shiny areas of hair loss, which in some people can be a permanent type of hair loss because there can actually be scarring to the hair follicle.
Mm. So we've looked at the pattern, but you think also people should be looking backward in time. What does that mean, and why should they be doing that in order to determine the cause for the hair loss?
Absolutely. So hair growth is a lengthy process, and hair loss doesn't always happen immediately in response to a trigger. So the notion that hair has memory has some truth to it. So there's a really common type of hair shedding called telogen effluvium, where essentially the hair cycle is shortened, like the growth phase is shortened and pushed into the resting phase, known as the telogen phase. But in order to manifest those symptoms of telogen effluvium, where you're shedding a lot of hair, maybe you're seeing it in your hairbrush or in the drain of the shower, it usually starts somewhere like 2 to 4 months after an inciting stressor. And this could be an emotional stressor, say like a breakup or studying for final exams, or a physiologic stressor. So the symptoms of hair shedding can start somewhere 2 to 4 months after the inciting stressful event. And for a lot of people, because lives are busy and our focus is elsewhere, they may not realize, or we may end up overlooking the fact that the hair shedding I'm experiencing today is related to a stressful event that I experienced, you know, last season, for example.
People sometimes hear, you know, the phrase, you know, well, you're losing your hair because you're stressed out. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do see this semi-regularly in the office. And as we just touched on, that condition telogen effluvium, which is like an overall shedding of hair, is commonly tied to a stressful event. So absolutely, the stress can play a role. But that being said, just because stress can trigger hair shedding doesn't mean we want to overlook other contributors to hair loss. So again, major psychological stressors like studying for an exam or say a relationship breakup can result in hair thinning. So too can more physiologic stressors play a role in hair shedding. So these stressors can include things like a major illness, high fever, surgical procedure, giving birth to a child, not eating enough calorically, because making hair is an energy dependent process. So if there's not enough calories in, body has to kind of triage where those calories go, and will often result in sacrificing the hair for other more vital organs, things like rapid weight loss and nutritional deficiencies like iron deficiency, lack of vitamin D, lack of zinc, not enough dietary protein. Those can all be underlying contributors to hair thinning. So we don't want to just say, oh, it's only stress. It can't possibly be something else.
So losing your hair connected with a drug that a lot of people are on, which is GLP-1 agonists. Are those medications directly damaging hair? Is that what's happening? Are people losing their hair because they're taking that medicine?
I mean, there has been a noted association between the use of GLP-1s, which have become increasingly popular and widely used, and hair thinning. But what we see in the research is there doesn't appear to be a direct impact of the GLP-1 agonist to damaging or being toxic to the hair follicles. What we see in the evidence, at least based on the handful of studies that have been done so far, is that it's the rapid weight loss, reduced calorie intake, potentially a protein inadequacy in the diet that commonly happens on these medications because they do work in part as an appetite suppressant. But it's the lack of calories or certain macronutrients that's contributing to the hair loss we observe in people taking a GLP-1 as opposed to the medication being directly toxic or harmful to the hair, if that makes sense.
It does. So we've looked at the pattern and we've looked at potential reasons why somebody might be losing their hair. Are there potentially reversible contributors to hair loss that people should be thinking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So mentioned a couple already. So again, are you getting enough calories in? Some nutritional deficiencies as well can play a role in overall hair loss, hair thinning. So where I like to start with my patients, irrespective of what's going on, but in this conversation, hair loss, is I wanted to take a thorough history before we do sort of a cookie cutter list of labs, which can get really costly for patients and not necessarily be helpful clinically. So questions I would ask a patient, again, depending on sex and where they are in life stage, is, you know, what is your menstrual cycle like? Are your periods very heavy? Has there been a significant source of blood loss from, say, an injury or pregnancy or childbirth? What's the diet looking like? Are we plant-based? Because it can be harder to optimize for iron on an exclusively plant-based diet. It's not to say it's not possible. It's just more difficult to do. Has there been any food restriction, maybe some disordered eating or going through a period of dieting? Or maybe we recently started a GLP-1 on a weight loss journey, and could that be playing a role? Are there any indications of a malabsorptive condition? Are they dealing with diarrhea, for example, or any other digestive pathologies like heartburn or indigestion that might lead us down the avenue of exploring, again, nutritional deficiencies as well as other underlying conditions like celiac disease, for example? Are there symptoms pointing towards maybe thyroid disease, like fatigue, cold intolerance, constipation, dry hair? So really wanting to be thorough off the hop in terms of examining diet, any medications, because sometimes hair loss can be a side effect of certain drug categories. Supplements become some micronutrients. If taken to excess, can contribute to hair loss. Again, as we talked about earlier, are there any scalp symptoms as well? Any redness, scaling, itching, burning? Is there any family history in the family of this type of hair loss? Are there other symptoms like new growth of facial hair or chest hair in women, which is suggestive of a hormonal imbalance on the androgen side of things? So based on a thorough intake, going through all of those different parameters of diet, supplementation, medication, family history, personal history, that helps us narrow our focus in terms of what lab tests might follow to get us confirmatory diagnosis as to, again, what are the underlying potentially reversible causes of the hair loss.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today to explain the potential causes for hair loss. Will you come back next time and talk about what we might be able to do about it?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
That was Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to get out of estrangement on The Tonic.
I'd
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Leslie Glass is a journalist, a recovery advocate, and the author of 12 books, including 9 USA Today and New York Times bestselling suspense novels. She's the co-founder of Reach Out Recovery and co-producer of the award-winning documentaries The Secret World of Recovery and The Silent Majority. Lindsay Glass is an author, screenwriter, and co-founder of Reach Out Recovery, where her writing on relationships and wellness reaches millions worldwide. She co-produced The Secret World of Recovery and The Silent Majority and is the author of 100 Tips for Growing Up. Both Leslie and Lindsay live in Florida, and for more information about both of them, you can visit reachoutrecovery.com. Welcome back to the show, ladies. How are you?
We're great. How are you?
Doing well. So today, you know, we're kind of finally getting to the core of what you two are about, and that is overcoming a strained familial relationship, which unfortunately I went through as well. So I thought it would be great if you guys could speak from the heart today about what you guys went through and how you overcame those difficulties. Sound like a plan?
Absolutely.
So I understand that you think that many people want reconciliation with family members who are there, aren't seeing eye to eye with, but actually aren't prepared for what it actually requires. What inspired you to sort of set that out?
So that's the crux of it, is that people who are estranged, they want reconciliation, but they actually don't always know what they want or how much work reconciliation actually requires. There's a lot of fantasy, you know, if someone would just apologize or understand, things would get better, but it doesn't work that way. So what inspired the book is we both did the work and we wanted to share the work and the process that you have to go through separately and together, that actually worked, and then share that so people had a real roadmap of what to do here.
I also want to add that Lindsay and I were estranged for 4 years. So our separation was real. It was painful. It was agonizing in a lot of ways, shaming as well. So getting back together, you know, our getting back together was, you know, life-changing for both of us. And it was a decision that took a lot of change for both of us, right, Lindsay?
Yeah.
And I think we had to get right with each other, with ourselves, before we could get right with each other.
And that was my next comment. I understand, like, the key underpinning for you is that you have to heal apart from the relationship. Why is doing your own work before expecting the relationship to change so essential? And what did that look like for the two of you?
So for me, I actually moved across the country, and for many, many years, I was in therapy, 12-step programs, all different kinds of groups and personal development things that helped me understand who I was, who my mom is, and what had happened in the relationship. And had I not done all of that work, which helped me take accountability for everything that I did in the relationship, I never would have healed. But years of therapy, 12-step programs, and mentorship and guidance.
I think you really have to understand that you played, that whatever happened and went wrong in your relationship, you played a part in it. And you can't just get together again and pretend that it didn't happen, you know, that what happened didn't happen. You have to be able to listen differently.
Lindsay, how old were you when you were able to sort of reconcile your role in the situation?
I was in my 30s, my late 30s, and it was truly the help of sponsors and therapists sitting in front of me, not just doing talk therapy, but listening to me complain and saying you could be, you know, exactly what you're saying is what you complain about your mom, and people being really honest with me and saying, here are your problems. Here's what you did. Here's how your behavior and addiction affected the relationship. And it's hard to hear, but that's what I needed to hear.
Do you think you would have been able to hear it and deal with it if you were younger? Like if you were in your late teens or early 20s? Or does
God,
it take,
no.
It takes maturity to get to that point, doesn't it?
Yes. And it had to take a kind of failure to launch on my part, mm-hmm. where I finally couldn't point the finger at my mom because she wasn't in my life. I had to say, this is your doing at this point.
So lasting reconciliation requires understanding the other person's experience before asking to be understood. And for many, that would be a difficult shift. How did you learn to listen differently, both of you?
Okay, so this is for me. And basically, I had to be able to understand Lindsay's experience of me and our relationship. I had to be able to understand that. And be able to sit there and be able to listen to her and hear her experience, even if I think it's wrong, right? I have to be able to tolerate hearing things about myself that maybe are not comfortable, and even that I don't think are right. So basically learning to be able to listen to Lindsay and be able to accept her reality. I have to accept her reality. And I basically have to accept the fact that maybe I was some of the things that she said, and maybe I have to be different. I have to be a different person for us to be able to forge like a new relationship, not, you know, put the old one back together again.
I think it's interesting that you said you said it twice, that you didn't necessarily agree with Lindsay's perception of who you were and what your role was. You just have to understand it, right? You don't have to, not everybody, like, I don't think you need 100% agreement in order to move forward, do you?
Not at all. But I had to accept that that's what she felt. That was her experience. And her experience was real.
And I just want to add, part of what I had to accept, you know, you feel like the victim sometime as a kid.
Yeah.
And in my recovery and my work aside from her, I had to accept the fact that she felt that I had been abusive.
Yeah.
So I didn't like hearing that, and I really didn't agree with it for a long time. But that was something I had to sit, listen to, and then process.
So the time apart, is it almost necessary in order to move forward? In other words, do you need to function on your own without that person in your life to understand better why you need that person back in your life?
Not necessarily.
I mean, we wrote our books because we thought what happened with us was very severe.
Okay.
We think that if you had a great mediator in the family or a therapist or, you know, we're not just pitching our books, but we wrote them to be like, what's your communication like? What's your, you know, if you can actually intervene a little sooner, if things aren't dire, I don't think you have to be on your own. In a situation like ours, where I really needed to grow up and have some independence, I think it was important. But we really urge families to work on communication and work on what's going on before it gets out of control.
And be able to look at the ledger. What's good about my mom? What's good about my daughter? What's positive about our relationship? What can we do right now to help each other, help and support each other without looking only what's bad about our relationship or what makes us crazy?
And you don't go back to the old relationship. Obviously, you have to forge a new one. And that's kind of like a learning process in and of itself. So what changed for the two of you that fostered the better relationship?
I think number one, it's being predictable. So it doesn't matter what our moods are, what's happened, what the circumstances are. If we say we're going to do something or not do something, we do it. So I think, you know, there's a level of trust, and also, you know, we've restored. So there were a lot of things that we had in our life in the old days that we have been able to restore. So we We're very respectful. Like, I know my mom loves to cook. I know she loves to go to the mall. So we actually schedule these things and do them together so that we have healthy activities that support each other.
We're also more direct with each other. So when things are going wrong, we can name them in real
Yes.
time, and we don't let anything fester. We also give ourselves permission that our relationship doesn't have to look like every other mother daughter relationship. So we're not necessarily best friends, but we are in a way, you know. We allow each other to be each other, be ourselves, be really ourselves without being hurtful ever.
Great.
So I'm sure there are people listening to this who are in a circumstance where they're looking for reconciliation, but not every situation is safe or appropriate for reconciliation. How can someone tell the difference between what is a healthy hope and forcing a reunion before everybody's ready?
Okay.
This is an important
Well,
question.
so I think that, the healthy hope is when both people are willing to look at their own part, when they're in that place where they can tolerate hearing something. I mean, we can't push it on other people. They're ready when they're
Right,
ready.
yeah.
So I think that first of all, you really need to be clear on if your situation was truly toxic. If there was abuse, if there were real breakage of boundaries, because those things play in a lot to your ability to reconcile safely. So if there were a lot of things that were unsafe or inappropriate, that may be a little bit of a situation where you can have some hope that things change, but you also have to be really aware that somebody needs to be working on
Well,
themselves.
and protect yourself. These are occasions where low contact might be a good idea, right? Not full reconciliation, not being best friends again, but knowing that there are parts of this person that you love, you want them to be in your life, but you can't trust them with your whole heart and your whole self.
Time for one last question, and that is if somebody listening today is estranged from a parent, child, or sibling and doesn't know where to begin to foster reconciliation, what's the very first honest step you would encourage them to make?
Okay, the first thing that we would advise is really to ask yourself honestly, what do I want to fix? What am I willing to hear that I don't want to hear? Really get clear, either on your own or with a therapist, about your part in what happened. And it's not to shame yourself, but so that you can have some clarity for when the eventual conversation actually happens. And I think it's not about like absolutely being ready to reach out, but being kind of clear on how you want to move forward.
What kind of relationship do you really want to have? I think that's important
And
too.
what are they capable
What are
of?
they capable? What capacity do they have for self-awareness and for caring, for being supportive and being caring?
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for coming on the show today.
Our
Thank
pleasure.
you.
That was Leslie and Lindsay Glass. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how all religions are more alike than not on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Edward Siegel, MD, is a California psychiatrist with more than 50 years of clinical experience. Throughout his career, he's combined interests in medicine, neuroscience, philosophy, spirituality, music, and public education. In addition to a psychiatric practice, he's been active as a lecturer, pianist, and community advocate. He received national media attention for his campaign to lower the key of the United States national anthem so that singers can reach its high notes. Well, that's very cool. His lifelong interest in relationship between the human brain and spiritual experience led to the writing of A Spiritual Journey to Know the Creator Despite the Limitations of the Brain. And for more information about Ed, you can visit www.edsiegelmd.com. Welcome to the show, Ed. How are you?
I'm fine. I might even suggest looking for a book review on ChatGPT. It's very good.
Okay. So you believe that religions, all the world's religions, more alike than they are different, which I thought was a really interesting concept. And in particular, you say that they all share sort of a remarkably similar framework. What led you to see those common threads instead of the differences?
Well, I was always wishing that, and I've been to churches, synagogues, shrines, mosques, everything, and I've enjoyed being at each of them, and I've seen people looking very peaceful and spiritual, and I'm just wondering, what's the big deal? What's the difference? And the differences are in beliefs and practices, but otherwise there's a lot of similarities. Can I go and mention them?
Yeah, sure, a few, yeah.
Okay, well, they all have to have a place to meet. They all have an organization. They all use words and music to elevate their spirits. They all celebrate life's major events. They all have symbols. They all have teach us right from wrong. All these kinds of things they have in common. The only thing they don't have in common is realizing that that we're unable to perceive the ultimate spiritual questions that we have. Where did all this come from? How did it get started? And we'd like to somehow communicate with that creator as well as we can, as much as we can.
But isn't that the point of the religion, to bridge that gap?
Yes, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. But however, you have to first recognize that there are some limitations of the brain in order for us to actually communicate or understand where all this came from. I like to use an analogy that dogs can smell and hear much better than we can, but they have limitations of their brains, of course. And dolphins have radar. They have a better social structure than we do, but they have limitations of their brain. I think it's, I'm thinking of the word chutzpah. It's chutzpah to think that our brains can understand these kinds of questions. Where did all this come from, and what's expected of us, what have you. So for maybe 32,000 years, religions have evolved more so in the past 10,000 years to answer these questions, and they do the best they can. So, but they're in different parts of the world. Different religions spring up over this period of time. Think of what's happened in the past 5,000 years in terms of development of religions. So they still serve a purpose. I think the main purpose, actually, Jamie, is a feeling of community, a feeling of belonging, and listening to words or music that uplifts our spirit and gives us some solace and hope when it comes to life, experiencing our lives.
Yeah, I think it would be like a bad sales job for the advocates of the religion to stay up front. You know, you're probably not going to understand this. We're probably not going to bring you closer to God because you can't conceive of it with your brain. I think that would turn a lot of people off, and then probably say, well, screw this then. I'm not going to do it. You don't think they do?
I'm not sure. I do know that these days, I hate saying this, there is a certain amount of business in religions. They need to recruit and retain in order to function.
But that's always been the case, though, hasn't it?
I suppose so. I don't know that is true among the earliest religions. I think they have to have a spiritual leader who gives them what the religion can provide.
I always thought there's a lot of ritual, religious ritual tied to death. You lose a loved one, and then that's when the religion kind of steps up and gets flowery and seems very hard. Like that's when the effort is truly made to keep one within the fold. And I think the reason for that is because if they didn't do that, people would be very disillusioned, right? Because you wonder why, like, why is this person lost? Why am I no longer with them? I'm in despair. Why is there a God? Why did this person go through a horrible death? That's when they really need to double down and keep people in. It's the same thing. It's the same business, don't you think?
Jamie, you've hit the nail on the head.
That's good to know. What are we going to do with the rest of the interview, Ed? Where do you want to go with this then?
Well, a lot of people want to know how I came up with this, what I call a laconic synthesis. It's become an 85-word sentence on what religions have in common.
Okay.
I happened to be traveling, coincidentally, and I found out coincidentally that I was going to be traveling through Morocco and Spain for 40 days and 40 nights. And I thought, gee, that sounds very interesting. I wonder if I'll have an epiphany. So on the 37th day of this trip, sitting on the Plaza Mayor in Salamanca, Spain, I realized, gee, I haven't had an epiphany yet. What do all religions have in common? So I took out a tablet and I started thinking. And that's where the laconic synthesis comes from. I call it laconic synthesis because most people aren't going to know what laconic means. They'll have to look in their dictionary, but it means in a few words. And of course, the synthesis is bringing it all together. And it sounds very intellectual. I don't want people to get all emotional about this.
So
does that make sense?
It does. So what does one take from it? Like, if you have the laconic epiphany, what do you understand from it?
Well, I understand that religions are more alike than differences, and they have a lot in common, and I would like them to know that. But once I had that written down, I didn't know what to do with it, and it took me many, many years to learn from a coincidental meeting with an interfaith chaplain that I could approach this by asking friends of mine, except for the Dalai Lama, I got permission to use his words, friends of mine to write a chapter on one aspect of their religion that's common to all.
Can I interject for a second? Because I have a question.
Sure.
What do you believe is the benefit of people understanding that religions are more alike than they're not? In other words, what flows from that?
Well, I think if people realize that, they'll have more respect for other religions. We've always heard about tolerating other religions. I'd rather people understand and respect. As a matter of fact, I've dedicated this book to physicians and to medical students so that they will know that religions are more alike than different, and they can use the spirituality of their patients to help treat them.
Do you believe, like, are you an advocate for religion? If we can't get closer to God with it, in other words, not because of the religion, but because of physiologically how we're wired, then what is the benefit of it then?
Well, we still have a feeling that we're closer to the Creator, and we're led to have that feeling through the beliefs and rituals, practices of these different religions.
So, if we recognize that we have these limitations, how should we act? In other words, what should we do?
Well, we should have a little humility, first of all. Even if we have limitations of the brain, that doesn't mean that we can't still, with humility and with questions, and have the opportunity to share what a religion offers us, which is a lot of hope, among other things.
So I think you'd agree with me that, today it's kind of hard to see how religion is sort of keeping us together. It's in some respects dividing a lot of us. What do you hope the readers of your book will take away from your message regarding the world's faith traditions that they have more in common? Like, give us some hope here. Where does that take us?
I want them to take away that religion is important and that we should respect and understand that the religions are more alike than different.
Okay. And that's and that if we believe one, then the other must be true then, right? If the religions are more alike, therefore we should value them more, right? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes. That's right. If you want, you can pick and choose to where you feel most comfortable, where you feel like you belong, where it relates to you, where you resonate with it. But that feeling of community is extremely important. A community coming together to try to do all the things that a service will do for us.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today to explain that.
Jamie, I appreciate it anytime. I enjoyed having you get me thinking a little bit more.
Okay. That was Dr. Ed Siegel. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss why people stay in abusive relationships on The Tonic. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Born Brazilian and raised in Geneva, Nicole Kranz has lived in Rio de Janeiro, New York, Paris, and Lisbon. Multilingual and largely self-taught, she has worked in journalism, communications, and coaching before turning fully to writing. Her latest novel, This Is Bullshit, Not a Love Story, is a candid exploration of psychological abuse, coercive control, and the struggle to reclaim oneself after a destructive relationship. Across her work, Kranz draws on personal experience to examine identity, vulnerability, resilience, and the relationships that shape and sometimes transform our lives. And for more information, you can visit www.nicolekranz.com. Welcome to the show, Nicole. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
So today we're going to talk about something we've actually never covered on the show, and that is why some people might choose to stay in an abusive relationship and what that might look like to everybody else who sees it. So how can an abusive partner who is the source of fear also become the person that victims of abuse turn to for reassurance, stability, or relief from that fear?
Actually, he creates a comfort zone. You enter in this kind of relationship, you know, in a kind of a feeling of being loved. And probably in my case is what I was looking forward to. You know, you always come with a failure in a relationship, and mine probably were the abandonment and the lack of love of my mother or my father or something else. But in that case, he creates everything that at first you feel totally loved. And when it comes to the part that he start to downgrade you, but then he will always uplift you. So there is this balance that you are put in that suddenly you are not stable anymore. So you don't know what love is and what love is not. You just enter in that bubble that he created so well for you.
How do those targeted by abuse become increasingly isolated, unsure of their own judgment, and afraid of the consequences of leaving?
It takes, as I said before, the comfort zone first. That's why, you know, in the book, I chose the metaphoric of a bullfight, because it started with a dance. And then he traps you in a very gentle way. Nothing happens from one day to the other. It takes a certain time for you to feel that suddenly you are not in a so much comfort zone. And the fear of leaving is obviously higher than the one of staying, as you are getting used to his manners and you feel that that's love. He loves me. And the feeling of fear of leaving him is just going to an unknown that is much bigger of what you are going through right now. It takes time to realize that you are in an abuse system, actually, because it's more than a system than the personality itself. It becomes a system.
Okay, you're speaking from personal experience. In your experience, do you believe today that that person loved you?
Now, I don't know if he knows what love is, because it's very, you know, there's the narcissistic part, and he has his own burden that he fulfilled in a way that he became manipulative and narcissistic and a pervert, you know. And then does he have the feeling that I do have? Does he have the empathy that I carry? They chose this type of personality that I am. You know, I'm a self-made woman. I love to work. I was very independent. But he always find the failure on you, the failure that he didn't resolve on himself. He's more scared than me to go deep inside the work he has to do to become a better person that I did when I left him, that I started my journey, the deep healing journey that I went through. So I'm not sure that he understands exactly the meaning of love, genuinely love. I think he likes to make sure that nobody can go against him, because what he shows to the world is love, because people will stay around you, but look at you, he loves you. Look everything that he's offering you. Look at the life he's giving you. That's the reaction of people from the outside bubble. But in the bubble, it's totally another story. And you feel that it's hot and cold, it took me a long time in any case to understand what kind of personality I was living with, you know.
Were the warning signs there all the time?
Not all the time, because he knew in any case to play very well with the hot and cold reaction, that, you know, suddenly he will be very gentle to you, and the next minute he will just put you down with a remark, a critics or whatever, and then he will shout, and then after the fight he will come back to you and say, no worries, don't worry, I know you are very fragile. And everything actually he does, it turns the situation that you have become the victim, you have become the person who's very weak, you have become the person who has to see a therapist. And that he knew very well how to do it, you know. And then you become so you lose your lack of confidence in a way that you cannot think straight anymore. You don't know what reality is anymore regarding love and a relationship. What you see is what you're having with this man.
How does coercive control gradually reshape a survivor's sense of what is safe, possible, and deserved, making the relationship itself feel like the safest option? Like why did you choose to believe that the relationship was better than not having the relationship, I guess?
Probably because of the deep feeling and the lack of love and the lack of self-respect. These three things all together made me go straight into that relationship, because what it was offering me was filling up those missing things that I was carrying on since a long, long time. Everyone has a story to suddenly go into this kind of a relationship, and we have failures. So mine was the abandonment, the lack of love, and the lack of self-respect. That's for sure. And so it was kind of, when I look back, I think it was kind of obvious that I will fall for him. You know, it's I can say today that I thank him in ways that without this relationship, I would have never started the journey I started after him. The journey of the healing, of understanding the power of self-respecting yourself, the power of treating the abandonment, treating the lack of love, going really deep into the healing. But I think I have to thank him for that. I don't forgive, but I thank him.
Why is asking somebody who's in your situation or who was in that situation, why don't you leave, fundamental a misunderstanding of the reality of the abuse?
Yeah, that's the question that most of the people, they always t- tend to ask, they think it's very easy to leave somebody. It's easier to leave somebody when you are in a kind of normal relationship where the codes are normal. You are not in a normal relationship. You are not with somebody who has the same code as me, with my values. So it becomes difficult to leave something that actually is well installed for you to stay, because it shows you that, but what you're going to have next, what you have here is just very good for you. No matter what, how much I speak badly, or I don't treat you well, or I use you a sexual object, look, I'm giving you my love. So it's very disturbing to, it takes a long time to understand. And in my case, it was really suddenly a friend of mine said, look at pervert narcissism manipulation. And at that time, we were talking about 2010. I opened Google and I looked at it and I just stepped back and I said, my God, I'm with that personality. And then the fear starts. So the fear of being with him starts because you realize that you are kind of within a danger, that from now on, anything can happen, because you understand with who you are. And that person is able to go very far in the process. So I think that moment for me was when I realized that, okay, now I have to wake up. And let's see how I can leave him without any burden, any violence, and it was a long process for me to leave him. Even though when I left him, I still felt his presence so strongly. It was very hard for me to be detached from him. It took a long time.
Rather than asking somebody, why didn't you leave? What's the more compassionate, revealing question that perhaps people should be asking?
It's hard. I think the first thing people should ask you is, how are you in that relationship? People don't question. People always think asking a friend or whatever what is going on in a relationship is interfering in a kind of intimacy. But I'm sure that people saw that there was something going on. And I always say the entourage has to help that person to understand that she's not safe, because they see it from the outside and they could just ask, tell me how you're feeling. I think it's important to start from somewhere and not to start directly of why are you staying. It's just feeling to take care. It's a caring moment that we need, that somebody suddenly shows that I can see that there is something wrong here. Let me help you.
How can survivors begin to rebuild trust in themselves and reconnect with their instincts and take the first steps towards breaking the cycle?
It's the journey I'm in. It took me more than 10 years, and it's a beautiful, the hardest and the most profound journey I think a human being can ever go through. Because you go in the deepest of yourself. And that's a journey that obviously the healing process goes along with therapists. The first thing is suddenly that to speak out loud that what you've been living with this man wasn't normal. You know, it's just a reset of your mindset that takes a long time to start, because you've been like brainwashed somehow for so long, and you have to start all over again to reach that point where you're going to self-respect yourself. And the day you feel, because it's only a question of feeling all that journey, the day you feel that you've been like, you respect yourself, that gives you the power that you needed at that time, but that you will have it forever. That's the most, for me, that's the most beautiful anchorage I've never succeeded. Because from now on, I know that I'm going to attract the right people too. I don't need the look of a man on me to know who I am. I look at myself in the mirror and I love what I see. And from now on, I can attract the right people to me because I have the self-respect. And I think that's so essential, but it's a long, long journey. And it starts when you leave him, but with a lot of honesty. And I personally, I never went to a rebound. I met some people, but I reset myself in a new me, in a me that I never knew even before I have met him.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Colleen Hartwick, Leslie and Lindsay Glass, Dr. Ed Siegel, and Nicole Kranz. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.